we're past a lot of the speculative financial booms and busts, and now we're in this new era. We have the infrastructure in place. We're talking about nation state adoption. We're talking about corporations putting on their balance sheet. And eventually, I think we'll see this work into all different industries, even unrelated industries beyond finance.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join me, Ryan Stubbe, Director of Bitcoin Mining, alongside our team of experts, Jason Ward, the head of FCAT Blockchain and Crypto, Parth Gargava, head of digital asset startups in Fidelity Labs, and Jack Newrider, associate at F Prime Capital. Every week, we roll up our sleeves and delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit the subscribe button for your weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are that of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is our first episode of the new year for the Crypto Brief. I want to welcome everybody and wish you a happy new year, and excited for this episode today. We have a special edition. We're going to be discussing Fidelity Digital Assets Research Report, the 2025 look ahead for digital assets. Joined by Chris Kuiper and Max Waddington, two of the authors from the report. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, same here.
So I want to start maybe by looking back at your report from last year. So this is an annual report that the research team for Fidelity Digital Assets puts out. And just pull out one sentence, and maybe we can discuss it to start, to talk about last year before we look ahead to 2025. And in your report, you wrote, "We think 2024 could be setting up for a year of acceleration in which we see increasing adoption, development, interest in, and demand for digital assets." I would argue that that's a pretty accurate statement, that that's kind of the year of 2024. Now, I'm sure not every prediction in that report was right, but I think that that statement was spot on. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it's funny. I think the analogy we used was, in bear markets, things get built. And we said, what's been going on is the foundations being laid. So if you've ever been near a building of a skyscraper or a very large building, it seems like it takes forever, where there's all kinds of noise and things going on and trucks going on, but you don't see anything that's happening. And that's because it's all below the surface and the foundation work. It takes months and months and months. And then all of a sudden, as they start putting on the levels of the building, sometimes it's one level a day and this like skyscraper just shoots out of the ground. And so that was the analogy we used. And we said 2024 may be that, like, prepare for acceleration, things moving faster than you expect in terms of adoption, development, interest in, demand, all those things you just said. And of course, I would say I wouldn't have even predicted all the things that actually happened. They were not on my bingo card. We obviously got two major waves, the exchange traded products getting approved. Totally did not see the absolute demand for those, the very, very high demand that was higher than all expectations for everyone in the industry. And then, of course, the second surge at the end of the year post-election was the other big one. So definitely saw that in 2024, and now we're looking ahead into 2025.
Yeah, no, great points there. A couple of stats just sort of off the cuff. Bitcoin in 2024 up 120%, give or take. Ethereum up 40%, 41% to be exact. And that meant that ETH-BTC ratio hit a three-year low. So we saw, you know, Bitcoin accelerate more than, I guess, the average altcoin and Ethereum in particular. As you mentioned, we saw the launch of exchange-traded products, spot exchange-traded products for both Bitcoin and Ethereum, beginning with Bitcoin in January and then Ethereum right around the middle of the year, I believe, not mistaken. And we saw over 1 million Bitcoin, so 5% of the supply that is now, you know, flown into these products between the conversion of Grayscale's fund and the inflows into the new products from BlackRock, Fidelity, and so on, the other issuers. Continue to see TradFi distribution channels opening up via ETP products and other avenues, and tokenization experimentation from TradFi. So that acceleration piece seems to be happening. So maybe to begin sort of digging into the report, you can sort of start from macro, or from like a wide lens here with literally macro. Chris, you wrote about Bitcoin and macro drivers in this 2025 look ahead report. You titled the section, or the beginning of the section, with "Why is no one talking about stagflation?" and sort of made an argument there. We would be curious to hear sort of some of your thoughts on the macro environment and what that might mean for digital assets moving into this year. In recent weeks, we've seen yields become unruly again, and maybe that's an indication of forward inflation expectations. What do you think?
Yes, to be clear, well, first of all, we started drafting this back in Thanksgiving of this past year, so this wasn't as talked about as much. And now I think it actually is. So we can talk about some of the data that's come out since then. But to be clear, this wasn't a prediction. It's still not a prediction, but good investors often are superior because they're always looking at a range of scenarios. They don't pigeonhole or themselves or try to be a punter on just one specific thing. They look at a range and they're constantly looking at the probabilities between all these things. And so we were looking at this, and I just looked at the data saying, look, inflation certainly has come down, but it's incredibly stubborn and sticky. The Fed still isn't getting it back to its 2% target. And if you are a student of history, one of the charts we have in this report is looking at the CPI changes, the year-over-year changes from the start of 1968 to 1983 versus 2014 through the end of 2024. And of course, we always want to be careful of any sort of spurious correlations or chart crimes here, but they match very well. And the point we made here was the 70s and 80s was not just one huge homogenous block of just high inflation for 10 years. It was actually two, really even three waves that came and went. So you got a little wave, then you got a second big wave, and it started coming down, and everyone thought they had inflation whipped and tamed for good. And then it came roaring back even higher. And so if you look at how those match up today, we got our inflation up to a 40-year high of 9%. It looks like we're coming down. The Fed said it's coming down. That's why we're comfortable cutting rates. But now, since that, we've gotten quite a few more data points. The ISM numbers most recently is what we were looking at. It seems like inflation really still is here to stay. Now, we'll see if that does accelerate and come back. But I think there's a real possibility that investors need to be prepared for and aware of as a potential, which is reoccurring or accelerating inflation. Now, of course, the other side we haven't seen yet, which is the stag part of it, of the stagflation, which is the slowing growth or contracting growth. Things seem to be pretty good yet. We just had a kind of a blowout jobs number this morning here. So we haven't had that. But if that changes, and things can change quickly, if we get anything less than soft landing or anything else, even just a regular recession, you could get these two things together. And of course, bringing it back to our conversation here, what does that mean for Bitcoin and other digital assets? Well, our research shows Bitcoin is the most sensitive and correlated to both inflation expectations, which, look at the University of Michigan Inflation Expectation Survey, that's going up again. And it's also very tied to or correlated to liquidity conditions. And so it all depends on how the government, both from the monetary side and the fiscal side, is going to attack this if we were to get stagflation. If it focuses on the stag, tries to reinvigorate the economy, that's probably good for Bitcoin. If it does actually focus on deflation and really tighten things up here, that could be a headwind, if we're honest with ourselves here. So we'll see how that plays out. But again, not a prediction, but I think something that investors should be aware of. And just looking at my screen this morning, we've got gold running as well, which I think is another indicator. What's very interesting this time, though, is you've got the US dollar quite strong. Usually we've seen Bitcoin run when the dollar is low. I personally think that's just more of a product of these other currencies that comprise the dollar index as being very, very weak, acute weakness in the euro, in the Japanese yen. And now we see trouble brewing in China as well with their yields crashing.
It's an interesting point that you make there. It's not just what happens with inflation. It's also what is the response function from centralized policymakers, from the Treasury and the Fed in the United States, and policymakers more broadly across the globe. And what is, and then from there, when you combine those two things, then that impacts, you know, financial assets and for us, digital assets in particular. But to your point, like, is like, do you view Bitcoin as, you know, front running some of those expectations? Like we saw into the year end, you know, Bitcoin rise in price. Was that, it's impossible to attribute it to one particular thing, and who knows, but is that more political administration change and some people viewing maybe regulatory environment changing, or is that a front running of the macro environment? Like, I think there was sort of an argument in the prior waves of inflation. We saw a large run up in the price of Bitcoin, and a lot of people argued that, well, that was Bitcoin, you know, sort of front running that ahead of time. And then once you actually saw the inflation, a lot of people, you know, sort of said, well, this isn't an inflation hedge because Bitcoin was going down in value because, you know, treasury yields were rising and, you know, inflation was peaking at the time. I don't know if you have an answer there, but
yeah, on that second part, we did address that in a recent piece, Bitcoin as the potential for a global macro asset, where I don't see those things as at odds to each other. We show with the data in that piece that Bitcoin closely tracks inflation expectations. So I do think it did sniff it out. Now that we've only had one instance of this, so we don't have a counterfactual, we don't have more data, but this is why Bitcoin is, like any other market, a forward-looking market. And so it's going to move on expectations. And then when those expectations came down and inflation expectations came down, Bitcoin went down with it. And then, as you know, CPI is lagging. It's always rear-looking. And so that's why CPI was at a 40-year high and Bitcoin was down, because CPI was lagging. It had already priced that in. Now, whether or not, you know, it's moving on regulatory changes or anticipations of that, or macro or something else, it's always a mixture of those things. Obviously, with the election, we got to see how much of it did move on the regulatory front. But it's always a mixture of these things, and it can always be these things sort of layered on top. So the way I think of it is the long-term trend, the adoption is giving it its bid and more of a long-term rise. And then on top of that, you've got a lot of the day-to-day, week-to-week, even year-to-year noise that's going to be influenced more by macro and everything else.
Makes a lot of sense when you put it that way. So yeah, so staying on Bitcoin, one of the big themes we saw was discussion of, well, on one side, you know, corporate treasury is, we saw, you know, certain financial mechanics from public companies that are continuing to buy more Bitcoin, and you would think impacting the price of the underlying asset of Bitcoin. We're seeing discussion of more nation states, I mean, for the most part, smaller countries discussing holding Bitcoin, but then also see, you know, a new administration talking about potentially holding Bitcoin or buying Bitcoin. Who knows how real or not real that is? I think that's one theme within Bitcoin. I'd be curious to kind of get your guys' take on. And then the other one is sort of more forward-looking. We're seeing investment in and the building out of various Bitcoin scaling technologies, Bitcoin DeFi related technologies. Want to hit on that as well. So maybe to start, you know, the public company buying, the nation state buying, what do you guys make of that and that theme? Do you think it's something that continues going forward with Bitcoin?
Yeah, I can take the first part, and Max can take the second part on the on some of the layer two stuff. But this is something, Jack, when you were on our team, we discussed already of more nation states. We expected to adopt it given the game theory of it. And also, I think we had in one of our look aheads, the only entity that hadn't purchased yet was central banks. And we're starting to hear a little bit of news and rumors of this, or some positions being put forth for central banks to consider it. So we think that continues. We think it only makes sense in terms of adoption of how this plays out. Why wouldn't you? You've seen countries take the first step. And then, of course, it's a lot easier for others to follow in their footsteps when some of that risk has been taken off and they're not the first ones to do it. So that makes sense to us. Corporations make sense to us. I think there's dozens now, public and private companies, that have adopted a Bitcoin treasury as part of their treasury strategy, I should say. They're including Bitcoin. That makes a lot of sense as well. And what's really interesting to me, and this is not in the report actually, but it's something I was thinking about the other day, is with every cycle on-chain, you can see the long-term holders sell into the strength of the next cycle and the short-term holders buying it. And of course, this is just pure data on-chain. And normally those short-term holders are more of the traders, the speculators, the tourists that come in and out with every cycle. And the long-term holders are constantly selling a bit of their huge stack, shall we say, into this. You're seeing the long-term holders sell again. And of course, the data just shows that obviously this is going to, quote, short-term holders. But to your point, Jack, about a lot of big buying by certain public companies and others, what if these short-term holders, as they show up in the data, are not the typical tourists, but they're actually people who have a lot longer time frame? Some public companies have made it very clear that they don't ever intend to really sell this, that it's going to be the bedrock of their treasury for the foreseeable future. And so I think that's something that's quite different with this cycle that we're keeping an eye on as well.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, I think like once there's one or two people dancing at the party, it's a lot easier for the others to join in, like based on what Chris said. So yeah, it'll definitely be interesting to see if that's kind of how the rest of the year shakes out in terms of those short-term holders, you know, transitioning more into the longer-term bucket.
The one thing for me is, that I'd like to see is like, not to call the organizations and countries that have been purchasing and public about it to be fringe necessarily, but like, it's not, you know, mega cap technology companies that we use in our everyday life, right? A lot of these are like very small micro cap companies. You know, some of them are a little bit larger than that now, but you know, tend to be very small companies that maybe you've never heard of that are starting to do this, that you could argue maybe it's, you know, trying to create some sort of relevance for the equity holders of that business, whether or not that's true, you know, you could debate. And then, you know, from a country standpoint, again, it's, you know, smaller countries that maybe have less to lose. I'd like to see a larger company or, you know, a well-funded balance sheet that that has something to lose by taking the career risk and you know, purchasing Bitcoin or something like that. That would be like a bigger statement to me. But again, who knows if we will see that happen. But within 2025, that would be interesting to see. And then the second part, you know, Max, you spend a lot of time on Ethereum. We'll get to Ethereum in a minute, but maybe on Bitcoin, building on Bitcoin as a theme, I guess, what have you noticed there? What do you think about it? Is it a sham and people are burning money building these things? Or, I mean, I guess that's kind of how all of this stuff starts, is speculation with no real use case, but you build the infrastructure first. What do you think of it?
Yeah. I'm really glad Daniel kind of went into the technical weeds in this piece specifically, because I think Bitcoin L2 is going to be one of the hotter topics in 2025. A lot of the projects have announced they're targeting 2025 for some, you know, stage of their launch, right? So I think we'll be able to finally see them in action with the technology behind them. And it's really hard because I think intuitively, you kind of just want to look at how the Ethereum layer two landscape played out and kind of copy paste that to what will happen on Bitcoin. But I think there probably are some notable differences in how this specific market will play out. Like you mentioned, the similarity will be, hey, there's going to be a bunch of people rushing to this door in terms of projects and companies, and maybe only a few of them will truly be successful. And that is similar to how we've seen the Ethereum layer two landscape play out. But I think a key difference to really driving that success is the technology that Daniel lays out pretty specifically. A lot of Bitcoin holders and people in the Bitcoin community really value the security aspect, right? And there's a reason they're prioritizing, you know, strong custody solutions and things like that. So I think that'll be a really stark difference in terms of the what we see on Ethereum layer twos, with just kind of the highest throughput security kind of on the back burner or as like a secondary priority. Those have really succeeded, whereas I think that might be a key difference we see with the Bitcoin L2 landscape. But yeah, really hard to tell. We'll see everything tried and we'll figure out what wins.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I've seen a lot of these projects raising capital in the venture space, and it is interesting. Like right now, it's the airdrop points games. There's not a ton of, like, from what I can discern, like real usage that leads to like a cash flow that you can look point to and be like, oh, that's like an underlying cash flow that you could assume a growth rate going forward and discount it. And not that doing any of that within crypto is difficult, but in particular with these like super early stage, protocols building on Bitcoin right now, there's not a ton of like real revenue or of any sort to point to. I think that's
Yeah,
just a
now
consequence of where we're at in terms of the development of all of these things.
that was similar to my struggle earlier, right? I would see all of these Bitcoin L2s raising capital and not really having any understanding of the tech behind it. Like that wasn't part of the value prop, right? But now I'm kind of starting to see that a bit more. And I think that'll really be at the forefront going forward in terms of what differentiates their products. Not maybe not necessarily the cash flows, but kind of the underlying tech that Bitcoiners would value.
For sure. And it'll be interesting to see some of them are, to your point, like trying their best to inherit security properties from Bitcoin. But then at the same time, like there are limitations that come when you do that. There are trade-offs, as we know, right? This whole space is about design trade-offs. And whether or not that camp is able to create products that are usable enough to whatever compete with the things that live on Ethereum or there's another host of products where they're just making massive security assumptions or reliant on like a bunch of layers of risk or other like node operators that have nothing to do with Bitcoin, but they're calling it a Bitcoin L2 or Bitcoin staking or scaling technology. And it's like, well, I guess technically there's you're holding Bitcoin, but you're the scaling piece is like you're just making an assumption that that whole network operate like you're adding layers and layers of risk beyond just smart contract risk on top of Bitcoin and really being secured by Bitcoin. So the whole point is just it'll be interesting to see how this space evolves and whether or not Bitcoiners are going to use these things and whether or not it has a chance at like competing with smart contract layer ones like Ethereum and Solana, etc. And on that note, maybe we move to Ethereum. Max, you wrote a section in this report on Ethereum. Feels like we're at a little bit of a crossroads. I mentioned at the beginning, ETH BTC, the ratio of the price of Ethereum to Bitcoin, a lot of people will look at as like, I don't know, an indicator of like whether people care more about Bitcoin and this monetary asset or Ethereum and the technology. It seems like Bitcoin is winning, at least if you look at the numbers of number go up of the price of Bitcoin versus Ethereum. Feels like Ethereum's at like sort of a crossroads where the community is trying to figure out what the future will look like. What do you make of it all?
Yeah, I mean, I love the chart. I look at the ETH BTC ratio pretty often. But I will say it's getting kind of less meaningful to me over time, not because number go down, but more because what I kind of argued in one of my previous pieces in terms of just how different the two assets are, right? Clearly there's this large current demand for what Bitcoin offers, and a lot of people are treating Ethereum like completely differently. They're using it for different products and services. So I think that's part of like why Bitcoin's just running away from everything, right? It's not just ETH. ETH had a pretty solid year at, I think you said 41%. Like that's still pretty great when you compare it to other things like NASDAQ or S&P. But what I really tried to focus on was kind of giving the readers what they want in terms of what we think will happen in 2025. And a lot of that revolves around narrative and relative to ETH competitors, right? So I basically call out Solana as a very notable competitor in this space. And when it comes to narratives, I do think that kind of relative basis will continue in terms of the strong Solana narrative continuing into 2025. And kind of a relatively weaker narrative for Ethereum. And a lot of that's based on the upgrades, right? The Solana upgrade, which is Fire Dancer, I think they scaled it back a bit and are releasing it in stages. But regardless, that upgrade they've been talking about for maybe 3 to 5 years already. And that enhances Solana's value proposition, right? We'll have to wait and see like what the actual results are and the metrics are behind that. But I see that as a pretty positive catalyst. Whereas on the flip side, Ethereum's upgrade happening maybe around March or April, in terms of the tentative timeline, is a mix of a bunch of different things, right? Some of it's a bit of a cleanup still from the merge, and then we have some other more important EIPs, but the narrative just to me seems a little less strong. But I'll caveat that by saying, like, I typically don't look at what I think price will do over the next year. Personally, I like to look over the longer term fundamentals, right? And I think that's where the value of these things will trend over the long term. So that's where I give ETH kind of the upper hand in 2025. And when I say fundamentals, I'm mostly talking about like developer activity, stablecoin supply and activity, and TVL.
And in this report, I think you wrote a little bit about it. I know you have written about it and we've talked about it in the past, of like Ethereum's roll-up centric future is sort of what they've been phrasing. Is that still the way that you see Ethereum moving, where it's like these L2s that are being built that roll up to, or roll down, whatever the phrasing is, to Ethereum at its base layer, and that is how Ethereum sees itself scaling? Seems like there's some like internal infighting of like monolithic versus modular, and how these, you know, where ETH transactions should happen and whether or not transactions on the L1 should be economically feasible or not.
That's such a good question. Definitely a hot topic in the community right now. I think it's not an all or nothing type of decision, right? I think most people are on board with, hey, we eventually want to make the L1 better over time, right? We're not going to fully ossify that part of the stack just yet. It's really just aligning priorities. Which is really difficult. A lot of the shorter term priorities have focused a lot on the L2s, because they've frankly just been really successful in terms of the users and usage that they're driving. So it takes a lot of work to support that, right? So that has been the priority, but there has been kind of a pushback from the community saying, hey, we still value the layer one. So we still want to make that somewhat of a priority in terms of the scaling roadmap. So we're definitely seeing that arise. There currently are a number, I want to say around 20% of all blocks for the past maybe month or so have signaled that they want to increase the gas limit. Right, that's a choice that validators can make and configure into their setups in terms of what gas limit they would like. And we're seeing that jump from like about a year ago. Nobody was signaling that they wanted that improvement. So there's clearly a community-driven narrative here that we still care about the L1 and we want to improve it. The debate is really about how to prioritize that with the limited resources they have.
Makes sense. Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see Ethereum and Solana, as well as like there's a handful of alt L1s that are being launched. A lot of people are talking about Sui now. I don't even know anything about Sui, but like people are talking about some of these like more move oriented ecosystems. Moned is launching, Barrachain is launching. Like there's all of these networks launching. Who knows where that value accrues, but it'll be really interesting to see how Ethereum responds, you know, to all of this competition, and you know, Solana as well with their upgrade.
Yeah. And I mean, just to add briefly, I think like a lot of people maybe a year ago were in the camp that, you know, there can't be another, there is no third or fourth best, right? The L1 race is kind of over. And I think that's a significant shift. I think the market is clearly still looking for a clear winner in that smart contract L1 space, you know, Bitcoin aside. So yeah, that'll be definitely interesting to watch like on a relative basis going forward.
Definitely. So I want to wrap with sort of the theme of the report that you all mentioned, I think at the beginning and the end, is posing the question of, are you too late? So what say you? Are you too late? Is it too late? Bitcoin reached $100,000 end of last year into this year. I think people look at that number and get intimidated. What do you think?
Yeah, the part of the report where we address this at the beginning is we reference back a book we read as a research team. We do a regular book reading, book kind of a book club. And a few years ago, we read a very academic book. It's called Technological Revolutions and Financial Capital by an economist, Carlota Perez. Now, to not put words in her mouth, she actually wrote this before Bitcoin was even invented. And I think online she said she doesn't think it applies to Bitcoin. However, of course, it's hard for us not to see how this theory could fit with Bitcoin. And her entire theory is that a lot of really, truly groundbreaking, earth-moving technologies, they have early speculative periods that are accompanied with financial booms and busts. And then you can always tell when something really has an impact on world-changing scale if the technology doesn't just affect one thing or vertical or industry, but affects all of society, nations. It gets diffused into the entire supply chain. It affects how people create objects or even communicate. So, of course, she uses the example of things like the oil industry, steam engines, microchips, the digitization of everything. Of course, it's very easy, and you can only see it looking backwards, that these things have had a profound effect. And so bringing it back to Bitcoin and digital assets, are we too early? Well, let's just suppose these are groundbreaking, earth-moving technologies, which we think they are. They haven't permeated all industries yet. They haven't changed the way we do business or communicate yet. So to us, we're very, very early if that's going to be the case. But we think 2025 could be looked back on as the time when this first started. We're past a lot of the speculative financial booms and busts that she talks about. And now we're in this new era. We're now at a $2 trillion asset class for Bitcoin, over $3 trillion for all of digital assets. We have the infrastructure in place. We're talking about nation-state adoption. We're talking about corporations putting on their balance sheet. And eventually, I think we'll see this work into all different industries, even unrelated industries beyond finance. So, of course, the energy industry is one that you can easily see how this could reshape those industries. So again, we'll see if it happens. And of course, this is not just a 2025 thing that's going to happen in 1 year. It's going to take literally decades. But that's the idea. And that's where we see a lot of parallels. So if you're asking, are you too late? Maybe if you wanted the speculative frenzy, you're too late. But in terms of the actual sustainable diffusion of this, very, very early.
I think that's a great way to end it. I couldn't have worded it better myself. And of course, I tend to agree with kind of exactly what you just said there. So thank you. I want to thank you guys both for joining this week. Thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back next week with a regularly scheduled episode.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information.
Fidelity Digital Asset Services, LLC is chartered as a limited purpose trust company by the New York State Department of Financial Services to engage in virtual currency business. NMLS ID 1773897.
Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution would or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.